A hospice is a place where you go to die, but it's so much more than that. This podcast from Loros Hospice will show you the extraordinary work that takes place there, the stories, the people, and above all, the patients and families who we support to make the worst time in their lives not quite so bad. In this episode, we explore how you help someone to come to terms with their diagnosis, to keep smiling and to keep living a full life. Today, I'm talking to Tracy Clipsham-Hughes, who is the Counselling and Bereavement Service Manager here at Loros. Tracy, your team work with people who are in grief, but you also support people who've recently received a diagnosis. That must be quite a different type of support. Can you tell us a little about how you approach that?
Yeah, of course. So you're right, we support families, but we can support people right from their diagnosis through to when they die, either here at Loros or at home. One of the biggest things I think we do is to work with people to see how they can live through their diagnosis. People are very frightened when they first come in here. They've lost control of what's happening in their world. It becomes about, when's my next scan and how am I going to live? So some of the work we do is to see how people can live through that. So what I mean by that is, what can they do? How can they go and be a part of their family again? What control do they have? So we try and hand back the control. We can't control the diagnosis, but what we can control is what they do with their world. So whether they continue to be fit, whether they continue to carry on with their family life. And that's a big thing with their family life, because sometimes people begin to feel inadequate, like they don't want to be seen. Depending on what their disease is, people can get afraid of what they look like. They don't want to be seen. They don't want to be heard. So we look at how we can change that. So how can they enjoy their grandchildren again? What does that look like for them? How can they continue to ride their bike? What does that look like for them?
So it's about keeping the normality of their lives going throughout a very difficult time.
Yeah, and it's a different norm. And that's part of the teaching, is that it can't and won't ever be the same as it was pre-diagnosis. But what it can be is something very, very different. So it can be still going out with family and friends, but how do you do that? Do you need to use a wheelchair? Do you need to have a scooter? Rather than do nothing at all and stay at home, how do you do it, but you do it differently? And people, because people become very afraid, and understandably and appropriately so, someone like me or one of my counselling team work with people to see how they can do it differently, so widen their perspective really. It doesn't take away the fear necessarily, but it does enable people to think, oh yeah, I can do that. I can go and walk around Bradgate Park, just not as far as I normally do. So, yeah.
And I guess some people are diagnosed and they have quite a few years left of their life. So rather than fear the future, it's important that they feel that they can continue to live life as full as they can, as well as they can for that time they have left.
Yeah, and one of the greatest examples for me was a woman who loved to travel on an aeroplane, and we spent many hours talking about her joy of traveling to different countries, and it was before COVID, and she was able to go and do some of those things and work through her diagnosis and work through her fears, but to go and live, really, to go and live in a different way. And we do that with a lot of people, because people stop. They get frozen in their diagnosis and their prognosis. And, you know, we work to try and figure that out with them. What does that look like? Some people don't know how much time they have. Some people don't want to know. Some people go into countdown if they're told what they consider to be the prognosis. And that's really tricky because people are counting it down. I've got 11 months. I've got 10 months. What am I going to do? So it almost gets stuck in the countdown rather than actually living through their illness, really. And it might sound a strange way of doing things, but this is all about how people could go and way to live and not just to sit there and wait to die.
And I guess in that it very much reflects the hospice movement as a whole, which is about living as well as you can for as long as you can, or here at Loras it certainly is.
Yeah, definitely. And I think people are quite surprised when they come into a therapy room and hear people say, well, how are we going to do this? What are you going to do? And we honour their fears and we honour their sadness. Of course we do. But it is about how we're going to make this as good as it can be in a very difficult and tricky situation. So, yeah. And with the families, to add to that, by working with the families, we have a children's and young persons counsellor as well. So what we can do then is work with the families to support the person who's ill. And they all work together. So it becomes like a family systemic therapy as well, and looks at the bigger things that are going on. Children continue to go to school. That parent or grandparent can continue to support them going to school. It's just how you do it. And what makes that a successful way so that people can still be a part of each other's lives, working through what it is that they've got to work through. You know, when are the good days? When are the days you can go out? How do you choose those days? If you feel good when you wake up, go and do something on that day. Tomorrow you might not feel so good. That's okay. But today I feel good. I'm going to go and do something. And that's what we look at. You pick your good moments and you pick your good days and you use those days and you go and do something on those days. So we encourage that a lot. And it really is people being able to change their perspective of what it is that they're going to do and understand that they can do it. And that's the control. I've got the control back. I'm going to go and do something today because I feel okay and it feels good to do so. It doesn't matter if it's raining or blowing a gale outside. If it's a good day, go use it and go and do something with it.
So one thing that we hear a lot in the hospice is that following diagnosis, patients feel that they can lose their identity a bit and feel less like a person and more like a collection of symptoms, and that's how they can be regarded. How does your work help counteract that, Tracy?
It's an interesting question, and a lot of the things to start with is asking someone how they feel, how their diagnosis has affected them, what's really going on for them. So some of the work is about how people feel about leaving their families, what that means to them, especially if they're a young mum or dad or, you know, or a grandparent. But a young mum or dad leaving their young family, there's a lot of work there that we can do with legacy work. Just people putting things together for their children. The emotional side of things is understandably really hard because they're talking about not watching their children grow up, not watching their children go to their first football match, maybe have a baby, get married. So it's two sides to this, really. It's how we help the patients to be okay with what it is that's going on for them. It's not about acceptance. It's just about, this is happening. I can't control that, but what can I control? And how do I make this feel more manageable? And some of that managing is the things that they can leave behind for their families. That could be writing letters. That could be doing some poetry. There's something called a magic memory box that I do, which is wonderful. And it's not a memory box full of things. It's a memory box full of memories. So for each person that they want to do this magic memory box, they create this image of this box. And it could be a dinosaur, it could be a football, it could be anything. And they decorate it first of all. And then after they've decorated, they put memories in it. You know, I remember when we did this. In my magic memory box, I would put that. And it's to the person that they're thinking about. So if it's a grandma with a grandchild, it might be that I remember when you were born and I remember what that felt like and I'm so proud of you now, the person that you've grown into. Then they do another paragraph. In my magic memory box, I'd put the first holiday that we went on and what you were like when your feet touched the sand And all of those memories they can create, and I will facilitate that with them. So they'll talk to me, and I will write the memories down and then put them into the context and write that up for them. So they've got these magic memory boxes that they can pass on to whoever it is that they want to pass on to. And that's a beautiful thing. And it's really, really powerful, because at this time, people don't always know how to or where to begin to start to write. It's really hard. Got so much thing, so many things going on in their head, so many thoughts, so much grief of their own, because they're not going to see people grow up. That I work beside that, and I honour the grief, but work with, so how are we going to do this? What would you like to do? What does it look like? You know, what colour is your magic memory box? Well, it's red. Why is it red? Because it's bright and it's shiny and it's wonderful. And working with that person, putting it all into the box, they're with me, they're doing it. It's exhausting, but it's really wonderful then to be able to put it into an envelope and say, here you go, pass that on to John or Janet whenever the next time is that you see them.
And I guess the enormity of trying to capture that can defeat you if you're, well, at the best of times, but especially if you're not feeling well or up to it. So you can facilitate that for patients.
Yeah. And we can do it over a period of time. So whether they're in the hospice here on the ward or whether they're coming to see me as an outpatient, we can do it over a period of time. And, you know, sometimes people can only do 10 minutes. Other times we can do a full hour or longer than that. And it's something that they've left that they would never have thought of. Writing stuff down and finding that first sentence really hard, but if I can facilitate that with them and give them an idea of that, it makes something really quite magical out of it. And instead of people having to physically put things in a memory box, we can talk about, actually, you know, how many of us know what their grandparents did when they were 20 or 30, but actually in this magic memory box they can put all of that. You know, when I was your age, I did this. You know, and it's like, wow, I didn't know that about that person, but now I do. And I always have that memory.
I think that's fascinating. I think also that a box which has got physical things in it are really only the same thing as that. They're just items that serve to connect with a memory. Mm. So actually, you just bypass the actual thing and go straight to the memory. And that's the precious bit, isn't it?
It is the precious bit, because people will put things in a physical things into a memory box, but it's the story behind them. So an example I'll give you is, for my own grandparents, I did my own memory boxes, and everything I put in there was a memory that I had with my grandparent. So rather than it being just something that was on a shelf, it was like a pair of socks that I would have had of Nan's, or her glasses, because she always had her glasses on. So it was what was meaningful to me. And that's what I try and do with people, is what's meaningful to you. What do you want to tell this person? What do you want to tell your grandchild? What story do you want to be able to tell that they'll never, ever forget and know all about you until they're well into their adulthood, and they can tell their children about you as well?
And I guess that goes back to taking back control, doesn't it? You're writing your own narrative and your own history for your loved ones that you're leaving.
Absolutely. And it is such a powerful thing. It's emotional. And it's beautiful. And I'm very honoured to be able to share those memories with people, but I'm very privileged to be able to pass those memories on then to the members of the family. The other thing I also do is something called an acrostic, which is what musicians sometimes start when they start to write a song. And if I take the name of somebody, Daisy, for instance, then I'll get somebody that loved that one to talk to me about them, starting with the name, the letter D, then A, then I, and it flows. And again, they'll just talk to me about that person, and I'll write it down, and then I'll read it back to them. And if they're happy with it, then we'll do it and produce it. So it's memories can be done in lots and lots of different ways. And one of the hardest things for people to do is to write a letter. So by doing an acrostic, it makes it an awful lot easier because it gives them a start and they just naturally tell me about that person and I write it out so we can, I can do all of that. And again, it's all ready then for when the person wants to hand those things over.
And I guess some of these things are obviously comforting for the family members, but also quite helpful for the patient as well. Does it help them to express some of this?
I think so. I my feeling is that when someone's doing this with me, they are being able to tell their story. And I think it's really important that people have got the opportunity to do that, whatever that might be, is that we hear them and that they're being heard and that we can sit back and we can do that for them. Being able to tell someone, I mean, if I was to ask you, you know, do your kids know about what you were like when you were 5 years old? And you might say, well, no. But this is an opportunity for them to be able to say, well, yeah, you know, my grandma was in the war, you know, the air raid shelters, noises went off, dropped all the money on the floor, went back to pick it all up. I mean, I don't know how I'm here today. And it's stories like that that never, ever get heard until we can go in there and say to them, what do you want to put in the box? And tell me your story. What does that feel like to be able to say that? How many times do we get an opportunity to tell our story? We don't, unless we write a book. But this way, we can actually pick up on some of those things that are really, really meaningful. What do you want to leave? How do you want to say it? What do you want to say? A lot of people can't even say the words, I love you, or that I'm proud of you. In this way, they can. Because they can say, I was really proud of you when I saw you graduate. They might not have said that out loud, but they've said it now, and that will resonate with that child, that young adult, for the rest of their lives, which it's really, really important. So, and I love what I do, and I think to be part of that journey is a privilege and an honour to hear those stories.
So, Tracy, tell me about patients who no longer want to be treated and they want to just focus on living life as well as they can for the remaining time they have left.
It's a really important question because there are two sides to it. People will be told that there is no longer treatment available and there are people who choose to not have any further treatment because they want a quality of life. Both of those two issues are huge when it comes to how people are from a psychological perspective. Understandably and appropriately, it's going to frighten people, that people are frightened when they come here. There is a lot of, go back to the lot of loss of control about what's happening now. People who are told that there is no treatment left available, we go into them as their grief about what they're going to lose and their families around them. And people who sort of choose actually not to have any further treatment, it is about what they want from their world now, how they want to be. They want a lot of people want quality rather than quantity because treatment can make them poorly. So people sort of say, no, I'm done. I want to be able to live my life now with what I've got and how I do that and be well whilst I'm doing it. So it's a really big choice about checking out what people want from their time and how we do that. If it's enforced upon them, because there is no treatment left available, people still have hope. People will always have hope that there's something out there. Whether it be some immunotherapy, whether it be something different, whether it be the way they change their own diets, whether, you know, just how they might try and help themselves, people will always have hope. And that's a human instinct that I see on a daily basis, is that hope never goes away. And sometimes it is then just about how that hope is used. I want to be able to fulfill the next holiday with my grandchildren, or I want to be able to fill the next Christmas with my children. And it's what that looks like for people on an individual basis, because it's different for everyone. Some people are very at peace with the fact that they have no further treatment left And some people understandably aren't. And it's a very tricky and painful subject to listen to. But it's what we do here at the hospice. It's what our therapists do here. It's what the nurses do here. We listen to the depth of the stories of the patients and the patients' families that come here. And it's, you know, we can't avoid it and we don't want to avoid it. People being able to know that they can talk to someone without fear of people walking away from them or not wanting to hear it. It's hugely important to a patient and their patient's family that that's what we do, is that we can hear it and that we can honour it.
And I guess for patients haven't been able to have that with their own families, it's much too difficult a conversation to have with your loved ones. And you can provide that sort of release to allow people to talk about things that are really taboo for a lot of people.
One of the greatest things that we can do here is give people the time to be themselves. They can come into our rooms, and for the amount of time that they're here, they can just be real. They can shout, swear, scream, cry. They can do whatever it is that they need to do. But the most important thing is that they're being honest. And that we're being honest with them. And we are and can listen to their story, no matter how difficult it is. We can give them that time, and it's the greatest gift that you can give someone is that time just for them to be themselves. Who are they? They lose their identity a little bit. And it's getting some of that identity back. What does it look like? How does it feel? You know, people have to change their identity. They lose weight. They need new clothes. They feel different. They lose hair. They get nice wigs. They can have a laugh about that or not. But throughout that, they can come into these rooms and they can talk to the counselor. They can talk to me and just be real. Mm. And I can be real with them back. There's nothing more important than being able to be authentic and being non-judgmental. So the choice of language is really important. I'll never say, I understand. How can I? It's much more important to say, I can hear you, and I can hear that it feels painful, and it's distressing, and I can see that distress. How would you like to work with that? What would you like to do? You know, do you just want to be distressed? Because it's okay to be not okay.
And I guess for a lot of patients, they're with their families and they feel unable to express some of that. So there's a cathartic nature of that coming in here and talking to you and just letting rip.
Yeah. And a lot of patients will say, I need to be strong for my daughter or for my son or for my grandchildren. They're still being the anchor in the family, even though they're the ones that have got the illness. And so then being able to step out of that for a while and not have to be the anchor of that family and hold everything together is a release, you know. And it is a release, and you can see that people just welcome the fact that they can just cry if they want to be able to cry and not feel guilty for it or not feel that they shouldn't.
Well, they're upsetting anybody by doing it.
The amount of times people say, I don't want so-and-so to see me crying. And I'll say, well, why not? It's okay to cry. It's healthy to cry. I've got to keep it together for them. And on the flip side of that, then, the family sometimes go to the patient and say, how have you been so calm about this? How are you being so grounded? And it's just that way of, it's almost like a miscommunication of things, really, because they're trying to be grounded and calm for their family. But actually, then the family are saying, how are you grounded and calm? How does that work? And with the help of someone like me, we can work with them to say, can you be honest with them? Can you just tell them how you're feeling? And the answer will either be yes or no. I don't advise. It's just a case of what works for you. And what works for one family doesn't work for another family. What works for one patient is different to another. It's a very unique process. Death and dying is a very unique process. And it's an individual thing that we none of us can understand unless we get to that point where we're going through it. We can see it, we can watch people die, but we can't assume it because we know how that person feels. So the use of language in the hospice with people is hugely important. And I go on about that quite a lot with people when I'm teaching or when I'm talking to the patient or families. The use of language is massively important, because we're not here to assume and we're not here to advise, just here to guide and explore, and to be appropriately honouring of what it is that person's going through. One of the other things that I find really important here is if I get a patient that comes in that's never been to Loras before, so this is their first impression of coming to Loras, is to come into the counselling room. But they know long term that they may actually come into Loras for treatment, for pain relief, or even for end of life care. One of the things that I do is give them the opportunity to walk around the hospice with me, so that I can show them the different parts of what a hospice is. Psychologically, if you think about something you've never done before, there is a natural instinctive fear about that because you don't know what it looks like. So you imagine all sorts of different things that are going on. So what I try and do is take away some of that so that it becomes real. And I will walk up to the ward with someone and just stand at where the doors open and just give them a sense of what the ward looks like and feels like. And not everybody wants to do this, but all the people that have done this with me have found it really positive because it takes away that fear of I don't know what it looks like. If you imagine the first time that you're going to go on a plane, people have nightmares and dreams about what that plane might look like. You know, is it an old biplane or is it got a great big jet engine? What does it look like? And the hospice is the same. Is if psychologically, if people don't know what it looks like, they will create a situation that can be far more distressing than the reality of what's going on. So I often will walk people around the hospice, show them the ward, show them day therapy, and just give people a sense of this is what we look like here.
I think that's so important. We hear a lot about people who come in and they think it's just going to be like a hospital, it's going to be really clinical, it might even be worse than that because people do die in a hospice. So for people to see it and to see that actually there's flowers, there's life, it's fresh, it's calm, it can explode myths immediately, can't it? Which we are striving every day to try to encourage people to see. But just coming into the hospice can be enough to dispel quite a lot of the concerns immediately.
Absolutely. And the reassurances that people get from the fact that they hear people laughing. You know, it's not... It is a place that people come to die, but it's also a place that people come to live before they die. And that sense and that feeling of reassurance of the comfort that they get from the nurses, but there's just the comfort that they get from being in a place that feels so peaceful. A lot of people will say to me it's a very peaceful place, and they get a sense of that as soon as they walk through the door. And that's what Loras provides as a hospice. It's not a place to be afraid of anymore. It's a place that people can come and be reassured that whatever happens, they're going to be cared for and looked after.
Thanks, Tracy. That's a fascinating insight into your work with patients and their families. If you've been moved by hearing this or would like to know more, you can email us at info@loros.co.uk. Do join us again for more chat and insight into how we care for people at the end of their lives.